Is everyone ready? Next case on the court's calendar this morning is request to approve issuance of state taconite iron ore mining leases. Could we hold off on starting the clock for a moment? There are several attorneys here. Who's appearing on behalf of appellant, relator?
Good morning, Your Honors. Jessica Nelson from Spencer Fain on behalf of relator Sabi Metallics Company. And with me today are my co-counsel, Matthew Kavanaugh, Kimberly Slay, and Johanna Hyman.
All right. And will you be presenting all the arguments for relator?
Correct.
Thank you. And who is here on behalf of respondents?
Anders Folk, Your Honor, on behalf of Cleveland Cliffs. Good morning.
Anders Folk, all right.
And Your Honor, my name is Oliver Larson. I'm with the Attorney General's Office on behalf of DNR.
Okay. Is there a sharing of time between respondents?
There is. Mr. Folk's going to take 5 minutes. I'm going to take 10. He's going to go first. And we did send the letter in, not that you're obligated to follow it, but we suggested that he's going to cover standing. I'm going to cover merits. But obviously, you may have your own views on that.
All right. All right. So 5 and 10. And your name once more?
Oliver Larson.
There we go. Got it. All right. With that, we can start the clock. And please be sure to introduce yourself officially for the record before starting your argument. We are recording the argument. And the audio recording is available to the public, not the video recording. So we'll need to know who's speaking. You may proceed.
May it please the court. Jessica Nelson from Spencer Fain, representing respondent Misabi Metallics Company. Your Honors, this court should reverse and remand the DNR's decision to issue 30 taconite mining leases to respondent Cleveland Cliffs. We've outlined a number of bases for reversal in our papers, but it really boils down to this. DNR did not conduct a statutory analysis or make statutory findings on a lease-by-lease basis. DNR only issued blanket, conclusory findings. And as a result, this court is left to guess whether each of the individual 30 leases satisfies the conditions that must be met before the DNR issues a negotiated lease.
Could I possibly ask you to address the threshold question of standing?
Of course, Your Honor.
And before you get into merits.
Misabi has statutory standing under Section 93.50 because it is a party aggrieved by the DNR's decision.
What effective relief would we be affording your client if we agree with you that the DNR didn't follow the law? And I mean, wouldn't the relief, the only relief we could afford would be to reverse and terminate the 30 leases?
It could be to reverse and terminate the 30 leases and remand to the DNR to consider whether the statutory factors are met for each and individual lease. And if the statutory factors are not met for each individual lease, then that lease needs to go up for a public sale.
Does it have to? Can't the state just decide we're not leasing this to anybody?
They could.
Look what happened from 2004 to 2021. Why are we going to go down this road again?
They could certainly hold on to the leases, but in either case, because they have improperly applied the negotiated leasing statute, Misabi was deprived of the opportunity to participate in a public bid. They lost the opportunity to participate in that process.
If a public bid isn't required, I think you just said the state could just decide to hold on to its leases and not award anybody a lease for at least some period of time. My concern is that any injury to your client is just entirely speculative.
It's not, Your Honor. I respectfully disagree. And the court need look no further than three of the cases that we cite in our informal briefing on standing. Misabi is not just a disinterested party. And just to remind the court, the statutory standing is a little bit different than the standing doctrine analysis. And under the court's Gillette Children's case, If a party establishes a statutory standing, it need not undertake the rest of the standing analysis. And here, the three cases on point are first, the Webb versus Golden Valley case. That's directly on point because, like Mesabi, Webb was a private landowner and sought review of the state's transfer of certain parcels to another entity. And like Mesabi, Webb owned the land that was adjacent to the transferred land parcels. And like Mesabi, Webb claimed that the transfer didn't comply with the applicable statute. And as a result, like Mesabi, Webb lost out on the opportunity to participate in a public bid. And there, too, I mean, there was nothing to say that the agency had to transfer those parcels, but the court found that because the agency did not, that Webb's inability to participate in a public bid was sufficient to establish statutory standing. And also, in Twin Cities Port Convalescent and In Re Black, the court found that an agency's awarding a license, a trust, to a competitor in the appellant, in the relator's same area, can cause competitive harm to the relator that is also sufficient to establish standing. And we have the same thing here, Your Honors. These leases are in Mesabi's project area. Mesabi is another adjacent landowner in this area, and as a result of the DNR issuing these leases to Cliffs, Mesabi has sustained economic losses in having to reroute its pipeline, in having to reroute its roads to avoid these leases. And it has harmed Mesabi from competitively entering the market. And DNR itself has recognized in the record that its award of the leases to Cliffs would make Mesabi's project very difficult to complete. And for all of those reasons, and in addition to the reasons cited in our briefs, Mesabi has statutory standing, and it's difficult to conceive of a situation where someone doesn't have a more interested stake in the outcome of the case. And Your Honors, a lease-by-lease analysis is very important in this case.
I have a question about that.
Yes.
When we decide, you know, the record includes a lot of things, right? I mean, we have the memorandum, if you will, that DNR submitted to the Executive Council that sort of lays out the big picture. But then we have each of the 30 leases. Do you agree that all of those are part of the record that we review to decide whether DNR fulfilled its statutory
I would agree with you, Your Honor, but the problem is that each of the leases contains the same boilerplate statutory finding language, even though the DNR admits that it applied condition one, the agency adjacency and impracticability condition, to some leases, and it applied condition three, the control of fractional mineral interest, to another set of leases. But the statutory language in each of the 30 leases is identical. It's identical. And as a result, and there's nowhere, the court can scour the record. And there is nothing in the record to show which lease met which condition.
And why is that significant? I mean, couldn't we conclude that the DNR appropriately exercised its discretion, authority to decide the state, that it was in the state's best interest to lease all of these mining units as a group, just as it had done for your client back in 2004, giving you all 27 leases?
The issue is that the best interest of the state is not the only factor here. The conditions 1 through 3, DNR here is relying on 1 and 3. Those conditions need to be met. At least one of those conditions needs to be met for each lease. And here, the DNR found best interests, and then it glossed over the other statutory requirements. And it did not...
How do we know that? I mean, is there some... I mean, I understand that the statute talks about, as it sets out the, you know, conditions, it talks about the commissioner finding.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see anything that requires express findings as to each condition on each, but that seems to be what you're arguing.
Yes.
What's your authority
Your Honor.
For the
yes,
need
Your
for
Honor.
Express
well,
finding?
First of all, the statutory scheme requires that each lease cover only one mining unit. And it's important to remember that the negotiated leasing statute is an exception to the general rule that these leases be put up for public sale. And the exception is only met if specific conditions are present. And here, and that requires that the specific conditions be met for every single mining unit covered by every single lease to throw it all into a blanket decision without making the requisite finding on a mining unit by mining unit basis, the DNR is not following the legislature's directive that every lease be covered, cover a separate mining unit. And Your Honor, the other thing is that under MAPA, the substantial evidence review requires the agency to explain its findings. And this court can and does reverse agency decisions where the agency does not adequately explain its findings, where the agency simply recites conclusions, which is what we have here on the two conditions, agency and impracticability. It's simply a conclusion, a bare conclusion. Impracticability, bare conclusion. Fractional control of fractional mineral interest, bare conclusion. And that's not okay. And point the court to In re Polymet and In re North Shore Mining Project. Those are two recent examples where the Minnesota Supreme Court has said it is not sufficient for the agency to simply recite the bare conclusions that are required under the rule or statute as its findings. It must do the math, show its work, so to speak. And we can't adequately, this court cannot have assurance that the statutory factors were met for each lease. The DNR did not adequately explain its blanket conclusion that the adjacency and impracticability standard is met for any particular lease. The DNR admits it didn't conduct this analysis on a lease-by-lease basis. And that's unreasonable, not only because the statute requires one lease per mining unit, but also because a lease-by-lease analysis is consistent with how the DNR issued these leases in the past. The state taconite ore means the ore in the mining unit being leased. In the prior leases issued by DNR, which Mesabi acquired, the DNR stated its statutory finding as, quote, state taconite iron ore upon the premises covered by this lease. The ore on the premises covered by this lease, and I'll point the court to DNR 6290. The DNR's new theory that it can simply point to the ore body in the entire area is inconsistent with the statute, and it's inconsistent with how DNR has interpreted this requirement on a lease-by-lease basis in the past. And I point the court to St. Otto's Home, which the Minnesota Supreme Court reversed and remanded because the agency's interpretation of the applicable rule was unreasonable in light of its past interpretation. And Your Honor, there also is no finding on impracticability. The DNR does not explain anywhere why it would be impracticable to mine the state taconite ore except in conjunction with the mining of Cliff's adjacent ore. There is no reference to the word impracticable anywhere in the record except in DNR's referencing the statutory requirement. That's the only place you see the word impractical. And what is more, even on appeal, the DNR's explanation is that, well, we didn't want to work with Mesabi, but that's conflating the best interest statute with the impracticability statute, and there's two separate requirements. And the plain language of the impracticability requirement focuses on the applicant's adjacent ore. And there's nowhere does DNR explain why it would be impracticable to mine the state's ore except in conjunction with Cliff's adjacent ore. That is nowhere in the record. And because the DNR has not adequately explained its reasoning, this court...
But don't the maps that it referenced in show the layout and kind of provide the explanation that you say DNR did not provide?
No, Your Honor, for a couple of reasons. One, there's nothing to show on a lease-by-lease basis. You can see other maps in the record that show on a lease-by-lease basis where the mining unit is situated, and we don't see that here. The DNR doesn't explain that. And we have pointed to several examples where the mining unit is surrounded by land that is not leased or owned by Cliffs. And in addition, Your Honor, the map says nothing about impracticability, and that is an additional requirement. The map, you can't tell impracticability from that map. And because DNR has not adequately articulated its reasoning, it has not issued its findings on a lease-by-lease basis, this court cannot tell whether any individual lease satisfies the statute. And for that reason, the remedy is for this court to reverse and to remand with instructions that DNR apply the statutory factors on a lease-by-lease basis, that it apply the plain language and adequately explain its reasoning. And I see that my time is up.
Thank you. Of course, you'll have 5 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you.
All right. So we are going to then hear first from Mr. Falk.
May it please the court, counsel. If I may, I'd like to start where we left off with regard to the court's questions as to standing. And specifically, I'd like to take a moment to talk through the Twin Ports Convalescence and the In Re Black cases, because I don't think they provide the support counsel would like them to provide for this idea of a competitive injury. Mesabi argues for standing based on this protectable interest to fairly compete, but as this court is aware, a mere competitive injury is not enough to confer standing. And the Twin Ports and In Re Black cases make clear why this case is not a case in which standing from competitive injuries is appropriate.
The briefing, of course, exchanged at the same time, so didn't have a chance to see each other's support until after you got the brief. Can you address the Webb case and distinguish it from things this case from that case as regards standing?
I'd be delighted to, Your Honor. So in Webb, the statute at issue, first of all, was obviously quite different. It involved a state statute that permitted the transfer of property that had been acquired by a public entity, by a state entity, for purposes of building a trunk highway. And it allowed a conveyance for public purposes to any political subdivision, government agency, or otherwise. And in that particular case, the facts are important because what occurred was when the state went to convey that property, they did indeed claim to convey it for a public purpose to an entity that would qualify under the statute. But the reality was the entity that was receiving the property under the statute, this public entity, had already lined up a subsequent sale to a private entity. And so the claim in that case by the petitioner was essentially that the state was doing an end run around what the statute permitted, and specifically transferring the property in a manner that was inconsistent with this particular statute. And obviously in this case, and so the loss of the opportunity to bid was triggered when the state broke the law, essentially, according to the petitioner.
Can I ask you this question? You contend that Mesabi does not have standing to challenge the award of the leases to your client. Who would have standing?
Your Honor,
does nobody have standing? Then what does the review statute accomplish?
Your Honor, a party that would qualify as having that particularized interest in these leases, a party that was aggrieved under the statute, a party could qualify for standing if it met those requirements. But in this case, based on what Mesabi has brought to this court and what Mesabi is alleging, they don't have standing. They have not alleged that particularized harm, that concrete injury, in fact, that's required, and they haven't proven that they're an aggrieved party. And so a party certainly could if it, in fact, was qualified.
Can you give an example?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, if by way of example, one of the other parties that had submitted bids, perhaps a Scranton or a U.S. Steel, if they were qualified and they were able to meet the threshold question of standing, I think they would be a party that could allege harm. But obviously, what we're dealing with here is Mesabi, which is unable to do those things and doesn't have standing.
What's missing here? Why doesn't, at the very base, why doesn't Mesabi have standing?
Your Honor, at the very base, if we look at, by way of example, the evidence they've cited to in both their initial brief and their reply brief, where they allege or they point to the record to try and allege an injury. In fact, what we see is a series of maps, a DNR frequently asked questions document, correspondence that predates this litigation, separate litigation that predates this litigation. There's absolutely no evidence in the record that shows that particularized and concrete harm that provides standing. And so we don't see any evidence before us that Mesabi has that. Separate and apart from that, as Your Honor indicated earlier, the claims that Masabi's making here can't be redressed by any decision this court's going to make regardless. As the DNR has cited, Mesabi is not qualified in the best interest of the state to receive these leases based on the 17-year history that's been kind of amply documented and litigated in this case. With regard to Twin Ports and In Re Black, quickly, in each of those cases, just to close the loop, a license was issued that created a competitor. In Twin Ports, there was actually financial loss to the petitioner, and the court found that the statute at issue in that case was passed to protect the public from what the court called deleterious competition. Those are all obviously very different facts than we have here. And in the Black decision, again, a license was actually issued that created a competitor. And the court in that case also found that the Supreme Court had, in fact, previously in the Suburban National Bank case, found that challenging a Commerce Commission license, such as what was at issue in Ray Black, was sufficient to provide standing. So again, a very different fact set and a very different state of the law than we have here. I see my time's expired. If there's any other questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, I will yield to the DNR.
All right, I don't see any, so we'll now hear from Mr. Larson.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Oliver Larson. I'm with the Attorney General's Office. I represent the Department of Natural Resources. I want to start with this observation, which is that Mesabi is a past participant in this process. In 2017, and again in 2020, the DNR and the Executive Council approved leases at the same site for the same ore, and in fact, the same 30 leases, really, that they're issued here. And the point I want to make is this. The DNR used the same processes in 2017 and 2020 that it used in 2023 when it awarded leases to Cliffs. And in 2017 and 2020, Mesabi never surfaced the arguments it's now making to this court. In 2017 and 2020, Mesabi never said that the DNR was required to go through and do detailed findings on a lease-by-lease basis with respect to each of the 30 leases that were awarded to Mesabi. And Mesabi never argued in 2017 or 2020 that it could only receive a lease if it had a parcel adjacent to the parcel that the DNR was leasing to them. And in fact, had they made that argument in 2017 or 2020, there were some parcels or mining units, whatever you want to call them, that were leased to Mesabi that would not have been eligible. And the point I want to make is this. Look, the law is the law, but I think the court should be appropriately skeptical when confronted with arguments that are new, that are novel, that were not made before, and that are being first surfaced by Mesabi in the context of litigation. It's clear that these arguments were developed really in May of 2023 with an eye towards preventing Cliffs from getting these leases. These are not organic arguments that reflect the position of the parties in 2017 or in 2020 or in 2004 when these leases were originally given to Mesabi.
Well, be that as it may, the argument was made to us that it's inappropriate for the DNR to treat all the 30 leases as one thing and not make individual findings and explain its findings. How do you respond to the argument itself?
Yeah, I was about to get right into that. A lot of the arguments they're making, and this is the prime one, is an argument that elevates form over substance. Essentially what they're saying is that if DNR had produced a decision document, let's take the main issue here, which is that, you know, Mesabi is incapable of mining this ore. And the issue isn't like a mining unit by mining unit problem. The issue isn't that there are mining units where Mesabi is incapable of mining that ore. The problem is that Mesabi is not capable of mining any ore anywhere. 17 years of history at this site have demonstrated that they are incapable of completing their processing plant, and they are incapable of putting this ore into production. And so it would be form over substance to say that what DNR is required to do is to produce a decision document that, instead of just saying, look, this company, Mesabi, is incapable of mining the state's ore, what it's required to do is have 30 paragraphs in that decision document going through lease by lease and saying, with respect to this lease, we find that Mesabi is incapable of mining this ore. And with respect to this lease, we find that Mesabi is incapable of mining this ore. And the record is overwhelming that DNR did make a determination that Mesabi is incapable of mining this ore, and that is in the decision document. I mean, if you look at, you know, the document that's there at 1138, this is the presentation to the Executive Council. It has a description of the history of the site. It then references all the Ramsey County proceedings from the prior piece of litigation. Those pleadings have extensive detail about all the problems that the DNR encountered with Mesabi and why it is that Mesabi is incapable of mining anything at this site. So the factual evidence that they're incapable of mining at this site is overwhelming. The question that you have is, was the DNR required to go through and have a document somewhere that went through lease by lease and said, well, yeah, also this lease, also this lease, also this lease?
Well, and also make the findings as to the conditions that provide, whether it's the adjacent iron ore or the fractional interest. I mean, I think the argument is there should have been findings on all of that, more than just it would be impractical to work with Mesabi. There had to be affirmative findings to support these each and every one of the 30 leases.
The drivers of the decision here are really global. There's, and if you look, like in the two places we cite them, in the DNR record at 173, 184, what the DNR lays out, which is true, is that there's really only two parties who have a land position that would allow them to mine this ore: Mesabi and Cliffs, right? Nobody else really has enough ore or experience or anything that will allow them to mine the DNR's ore. So if the DNR is going to put this ore into production, there's only two companies that might be able to do it: Mesabi or Cliffs. And what the record also shows is that Mesabi can't do it, which really leaves the DNR in the position of saying, look, we're either going to lease this ore to Cliffs or to no one. There's no other option for getting this stuff leased up. And that's in the record. And so, again, if the drivers of the decision-making are global, if they apply to all of these leases, then it is form over substance to say that we need to atomize the decision-making and go through on a lease-by-lease basis when the drivers of the decision-making are really things that apply to the entire project, which is what is true here. And I will say, again, to the argument of form over substance, there is no argument in the briefing from Mesabi about what would have been different if DNR had gone through on a lease-by-lease basis. They don't kind of give you a flavor for, like, well, had DNR gone through on a lease-by-lease basis, the decision would have been different, and here's why.
Do you think it's a harmless error sort of situation?
I don't know if it's a harmless error, but I think, again, I think you pointed out accurately that there's nothing in these statutes that says that DNR is required to go through and do a lease-by-lease analysis, right? And there are statutes like that. There are statutes that erect obstacles in front of an agency that say, if when an agency makes this kind of a decision, here are the things that they need to do. In the absence of that, what they're really saying is that the three of you, as judges in this case, should erect those obstacles in front of DNR. And my suggestion is this. If you're going to erect those obstacles, you should be asking the question about, you know, does it make sense to require DNR to do a lease-by-lease analysis in this kind of a context? If it's not required by the statute, is it something that you should impose upon DNR? If it's form over substance, you shouldn't. And so that's, I think, really the argument here is that, you know, there's just not an argument on how the decision would have been different. And so what they're really saying is that you should remand for DNR to go through this exercise of simply repeating itself with respect to each lease instead of presenting. And one more point on this. The DNR's presentation is made to the Executive Council, right? And optics of this, right? Five very busy people, statewide office holders. The idea that we would make a presentation to the Executive Council that goes through on a lease-by-lease basis all factors when we can fairly brief them by saying, look, here is the context in which these decisions are being made. If there are global factors driving the decisions, that's how the Executive Council should be briefed. That's how they're making their decision. I think that's how this court should also make its decision.
I want to ask you a question about standing, because I know you took the position in the briefing that this court asked for earlier that Mesabi lacks standing. How do you respond to their argument that they have statutory standing? What does that mean to you, and how do you
There's still the equivalent of like an Article III requirement, right? I mean, courts can't function unless there is a redressable injury, and I think that is the failure here. Like, whatever they may think of the decision that has been made, essentially what they're asking you for is to do injury to somebody else, to do injury to Cliffs, not to resolve an injury that they themselves have suffered. And that's the redressability issue that I think is the basic kind of fundamental error here, which is that even if a statute provides this court or the court's more generous standing, you still have to meet that kind of Article III injury type of analysis, and it's just not present here. Now, and I'll be candid, like, we did not brief into this issue because, I'll just say it, like, we've not been particularly successful in front of this court on RUN standing. We're very selective these days about, you know, where we pick up standing because we don't want to see a decision that then the next litigant uses to make an even, you know, more further out argument for standing. So, but I do think if you dive into the redressability issue here, there's a failure of standing on that basis. And to your point, who could actually challenge these decisions? I would say, like, the parties who might have standing to challenge a decision like this would be the beneficiaries of the trust. So if the DNR and the Executive Council, let's say, approved leases for Cliffs that had a royalty rate of like a penny a ton, and the university trust or the local taxing authorities or the school trust, which are the entities that benefit from that, I think they would have standing to come and say, hey, wait a minute, you've approved leases that have royalty rates that are far below market, and we're injured as a result of that because we're the beneficiaries of this. So I do think these decisions could be challenged, and I will also say, kind of dovetailing to that, that is the purpose of the statute, right, is to ensure that these, you know, trust beneficiaries are receiving adequate proceeds from the resources they hold. The point of these statutes is not to ensure that some other mining company can get the ore and mine it. It's really there for the protection of these public interest holders. One other issue I just want to get into, the adjacency argument, I don't know how to describe it, right? It's, to me, it seems obvious, but we've spent a lot of ink on it, and I'm wondering if we're really just confusing the issue. So I'm going to try and give you what I think is the best analogy. So if you go up to the site, the ore is underground, but let's imagine that we strip off all the stuff that's on top of the ore. I think the argument is as simple as this. You take any place on that ore body that's owned by the DNR. If you can walk from that point in space to a point in space where Cliffs has ore, and you can do that without crossing anybody else's ore or without having interruptions in ore, you're walking on ore the whole time, then those two ore bodies are adjacent, and that meets the requirement of 93-1925. It talks about ore being adjacent. You know, mining units, parcels, these are ways that we frame up what's, you know, the world so that we can describe it in a legal document. But what 93-1925 is driving at is the ore next to the ore. And here, I mean, just look at the maps. It's very clear that Cliffs and the state have intermixed ore and that they are adjacent. And the idea that, one last argument, which is that under Mesabi's argument, essentially the DNR would be limited to just leasing up the perimeters of its ore positions. And that's not what the statute means. So unless you've got any questions, I'll yield.
No questions, thank you. Rebuttal?
Your Honors, the fact that the DNR is so focused on Mesabi and is trying to justify the statutory factors based on Mesabi shows that this decision was an exercise of the DNR's will rather than its judgment. This isn't form over substance. This is about both form and substance, and both are important under MAPPA. There must be findings, and those findings must be reasonable and must be based on the plain language of the statute. They are not here. They are not here. DNR has said nothing about why it's impracticable to mine the state's ore with Cliff's ore. And this isn't a harmless error, because we have shown a number of examples and a number of bases of ways that the leases do not, in fact, meet the statutory requirements. The mining units that are surrounded by ore other than Cliffs. The fact that Scranton and U.S. Steel could have practicably mined this with their adjacent ore. And the fact that some of these shared parcels cannot be mined in connection with the state's ore at this time, because that is tied up in litigation in Delaware. Cliffs does not have a legal right to mine the ore on any of the shared parcels at this moment. And so it cannot be impracticable to mine the state ore except in conjunction with Cliffs adjacent ore, because right now Cliffs adjacent ore cannot be mined on those parcels.
But again, that goes to, so if we agree with you, how does that provide redress to your client?
Again, redressability, the Article III standards are in federal court. We're in state court. The state courts have said that statutory standing is sufficient, that you don't need to show redressability and traceability in the same way in that context under the Gillette case. But it's redressable, Your Honor, because if the leases don't meet the statutory factors under the negotiated lease exception, then they either go up for public bid or the DNR holds on to them for a time. And either of those things would redress Mesabi's injuries, because either Mesabi would get the chance to participate in a public bid, and there's no best interest factor in the public bid. It's the amount of the royalty. That's what the DNR is to consider under the public bid statute. So the lack of being able to participate in that process, as well as having a competitor, Cleveland Cliffs, who has stated publicly that it is going to use the state leases to throw grenades and sink Mesabi. The fact that DNR awarded these leases to Mesabi's competitor, and now Mesabi has incurred economic losses as a result of that. It has had to restructure its mining infrastructure. It has had to reroute roads. It has sustained economic injury.
Is that in the record?
It is, Your Honor. If you look at the maps in the record, and we've cited to them in our standing section of our briefing, but if you look at the maps, you can tell that Mesabi's tailings basin pipeline, for example, that its stormwater infrastructure are located on properties that were previously leased. It now has to move those because Cliffs has those leases. And, Your Honors, I come back to where I started, which is that the DNR has made blanket conclusory findings on the two conditions that are required under the negotiated leasing statute. And as a result, this court cannot properly review, much less affirm, each of these 30 leases. And so Mesabi respectfully requests that this court reverse and remand the decision to the DNR to vacate those leases and to take a look at this on a lease-by-lease basis and to properly address and explain its findings so that this court has assurance that the statutory factors are met. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
No further questions.
Thank you for the arguments and the briefing. The matter is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days.